Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 17. Mesmerism. Dick was a great success. He had a way with him and with everybody. Miss Magoon may have had some misgivings at first when she saw the rigid economy exercised by Mary in the furnishings of the apartment on the second floor. Only the most necessary articles of furniture, paper, oil, cloth on the floors, and the cheapest shades at the windows. But as the patients arrived in ever-increasing numbers, she began, rather incredulously, at first no doubt, to take heart of grace. By the end of the month, when the rent was paid promptly and fully, she was completely won over. Moreover, Dr. Kennedy was a most agreeable person. He had a pleasant word for everyone, and within a few weeks had secured the devotion of the children in the school. Busy as he was, he would somehow manage to run downstairs about the time the pupils were being dismissed for the day, and help Miss Magoon with the task of getting the younger children into their wraps and overshoes. Then, naturally, when the patients were so numerous as to overtax the waiting accommodation on the second floor, Miss Magoon would cheerfully place her parlor on the third at the young doctor's disposal. She always had a good word for him among her friends and with the parents of her pupils, and as her school was in good standing, success for Dick succeeded as only success can. Go to Dr. Kennedy. He can't hurt you, even if he doesn't help you, became a common admonition from their friends to discouraged invalids. And they seem to have taken the advice in ever larger numbers. Many of those who came to Richard for treatment went on to Mrs. Patterson for teaching, and so, outwardly at least, their plan was succeeding even beyond their most sanguine expectation. Richard Kennedy undoubtedly thought so, and with every reason. But Mary seems to have been more than doubtful. She was learning very rapidly, and the troubled passage of the first class had taught her much. Some things almost baffled her. The practice of manipulation, which she had inherited from Quimby, and to which, up to now, she had loyally adhered, troubled her most of all. As practiced by Quimby in connection with the explanation of his wisdom, it had never seemed to create any difficulty. The presentation had moved forward as one consistent whole, but the inconsistency between what she was teaching about the allness of mind and the nothingness of matter and the apparent re-enthronement of matter involved in manipulation seemed to her to become more glaring every day. Putney Bancroft probably put it mildly when he said that to some of them it seemed a paradox. It was a puzzling situation. The physical manipulation was supposed to make the students more receptive. Yet, Mary Patterson found, much to her bewilderment, that far from this being the case, she had to labor as she had never labored before in order to lift the thought of her students into a mental atmosphere of sufficient calmness and spirituality to apprehend anything of what she was trying to teach. The downward tendency of manipulation was quite definite, and with many members of the class, the mental wrench involved in passing from physical practice to spiritual teaching were so violent as to cause them to become confused and resentful. But the solution this crisis demanded brought her teaching quickly into a freer atmosphere. When Mary finally did see this, she was immediate and thorough in her action. She required her students to score from the manuscripts she had given them all references to manipulation, insisted that it was pure mesmerism, and banished it forever from her class and teaching. In her first edition of Science and Health, published a few years later, her repudiation of the practice is final and emphatic. "Sooner suffer a doctor infected with smallpox to be about you," she wrote, "than come under the treatment of one that manipulates his patients' heads and is a traitor to science." Mary Patterson's conviction on this point was not, as may well be imagined, at all welcome to Richard Kennedy. Manipulation was an established feature of his method, which had become known beyond the circle of his regular patients. He had become an expert in its use, and experience had proved to him that, far from minimizing its importance, the more he could make of it, the better. He found it especially efficacious with women patients. The very ceremony of taking down the hair before treatment and drying and putting it up afterwards suggested to them that something important was being done in their behalf, and they responded most favorably. In fact, he never did attempt to do anything more than this, it is said. He did not pretend to teach. He left that to his partner. Years afterwards, when called upon to testify in court as to his practice about this time, he made his position quite clear. "I went to Lynn to practice with Mrs. Eddy. Our partnership was only in the practice, not in her teaching. I practiced healing the sick by physical manipulation. The mode was operating upon the head, giving vigorous rubbing." He then went on to relate how Mrs. Eddy had tried to teach him the science of healing by soul power, but that he never had been able to understand it. This, of course, was after the lapse of years, when the recollection of his long and eager discussions with Miss Bagley and Mary Patterson at Amesbury and the early vision of their great undertaking had become blurred, but it shows clearly his position. When, therefore, Mary came to her young disciple, Richard, after her first class and told him of her decision, she found herself confronted with a problem which, in varying forms, was to present itself to her at every turn in the future. The problem of the student who would not or could not advance with her, who entered her teaching at a certain point, and out of what he found or thought he found at that point, evolved something of his own. Richard Kennedy refused to give up manipulation. He was the first of several. As Bancroft puts it, some of her pupils refused to comply. Dr. Kennedy was one of them, and after laboring with him for some time, she was obligated to sever the partnership which existed between them. the conviction that manipulation in general, and Richard Kennedy's practice of it in particular, was pure mesmerism, did not come to Mary in any sudden revelation. It is, indeed, clear from Bancroft's account of it that, at first, she was inclined to think it was the character and amount of manipulation that was at fault, and she sought to get over the difficulties bound up with its use by suggesting modifications. Water was, first of all, eliminated from the head-rubbing process, and the process itself considerably shortened. Later on, under pressure of a growing conviction, the whole preliminary exercise was greatly reduced. That Kennedy viewed these developments with increasing disfavor cannot be doubted. And for the next 12 months, the relationship between the two must have been characterized by that process of disagreement and compromise which can only have one outcome. Meanwhile, the arrangement was profitable to both parties. In a little notebook of Mrs. Eddy's, still preserved, are careful records of her receipts and expenditures at this period. These show that from June 1870 to May 1871, Mrs. Patterson's share of the receipts was $1,742. As the division was made after the deduction of all expenses, rent, living costs, and so on, it is clear that, from a financial point of view, the partnership was a complete success. It was, however, for Mary, a hard and rugged road. The tumult of her first class did not come to an end at the close of the final session. There were long lulls in the storm, but for years afterwards, the flotsam and jetsam of its wreckage would be cast up on the shore. The first great outburst occurred more than a year after its close. The central figure was Wallace W. Wright, the man whose written questions at the time of the class Mrs. Patterson had answered so fully. Mary's answers had apparently more than satisfied him, and he left the class full of enthusiasm for the new teaching. He seems to have practiced in Lynn for some time, evidently profiting by Mrs. Patterson's ever-readiness to help and further instruct, which Bancroft mentions. And then, early in the summer of 1871, he set out for Knoxville, Tennessee, where he had connections, planning to enter into the practice of spiritual healing there with another of Mrs. Patterson's students. At first, he seems to have had considerable success. But later on, for some reason that he could not understand, he began to lose his power. And as more and more cases came his way which utterly refused to yield to treatment, he began to have doubts. From doubts, he went on to convictions. And the conviction he finally reached was that what he had learned and had been practicing was mesmerism and nothing else. As soon as he was satisfied on this point, he wrote to Mary in Lynn, demanding that she refund the fees he had paid her, and telling her just what he thought of her and her teaching. If it had been a simple case of inability to demonstrate what he had learned, Mary would not, in all probability, have hesitated to return the money. She had shown herself more than generous in this regard. But in this case, to return the money would have been virtually to admit that Wright's charge was true, and that her teaching was mesmerism. Coming as it did at the time when her suspicions as to Kennedy's part in it were reaching the point of conviction, this was the last thing Mary would admit. She absolutely refused to do as Wright demanded. A few months later, Wright himself was back in Lynn. He called on Mary and renewed his demand. And when Mary again refused, he decided to thrash the whole matter out in the public press. It was a particularly cruel form of attack, but one to which Mary was to become accustomed in the future. The first broadside came in the Lynn Transcript, January 13, 1872. Beginning at the beginning, Mr. Wright says, "The 9th of last June found me in Knoxville, Tennessee, as assistant to a former student. We met with good success in a majority of our cases, but some of them utterly refused to yield with treatment. Soon after settling in Knoxville, I began to question the propriety of calling this treatment moral science instead of mesmerism. Away from the influence of argument, which the teacher of this so-called science knows how to bring to bear upon students with such force as to outweigh any attempts they may make at the time to oppose it, I commenced to think more independently, and to argue with myself as to the truth of the positions we were called upon to take. The result of this course was to convince me that I had studied the science of mesmerism." This was more than enough for Mary. The following week, she replied fully to Wright. She did not attempt to deal with his charges of teaching mesmerism, but she did indicate what Wright's real purposes were, namely, simple extortion and revenge. She said he had demanded from her not only the return of his tuition fee, but $200 damages extra, and threatened that if she did not comply, he would see to it that she should never hold another class in Lynn. The controversy was taken up with less wisdom than zeal by several of Mary's students who rushed to her defense. Wright was in his element, and finally, after much writing back and forth, he issued a challenge to Mrs. Patterson to give a public demonstration of the practical value of her teaching by methods he would enumerate. In return, he promised that if she was successful, he would retract all his charges, asking forgiveness publicly for the course he had taken. He added that refusal to comply, by silence or otherwise, should be considered a failure for her cause. The methods of proof he proposed were as follows. First, to restore the dead to life again. Second, to walk upon the water without the aid of artificial means. Third, to live 24 hours without air, or 24 days without nourishment of any kind without its having effect upon her. Fourth, to restore sight when the optic nerve has been destroyed. Fifth, to set and heal a broken bone without the aid of artificial means. Mary Patterson very naturally ignored this challenge, but some of her followers, not so wise, joined issue with vigor, repudiating Wright's charges and bearing testimony to the high character of their teacher and the true spirituality of her teaching. Mr. Wright was exultant. Mrs. Patterson, he declared, had, as he knew she would, utterly failed to meet his demands, and that it must be clear to everyone that both she and her science were practically dead and buried, which, after all, was a singularly unfortunate excursion into the realm of prophecy. The whole incident served to bring into focus for Mary, as nothing else perhaps could have done, the dangerous tendency of all students to stop at a particular point instead of going along with the evolving doctrine as it necessarily progressed with advancing discernment. This was, of course, highlighted by the controversy over Kennedy's manipulations, and it was soon afterwards that she and Richard came to the parting of the ways. She was evidently very much attached to him at one time, entertaining high hopes for his future, and the breakup of their partnership would mean for her a complete realignment of her plans. The arrangement they had agreed upon in Amesbury had worked out well. The more successful Richard was in demonstrating the value and practicality of her teaching, the more eager were those thus helped to learn more about it from her. But now she could not be certain that what Richard was doing was really a demonstration of spirituality. And as the days and weeks passed, and she saw more and more of the character of his work, she gradually concluded that it was not. It was, of course, all new to her, as it was to Kennedy. But it must have been with grave misgivings that she saw the large and increasing number of people, mostly women, who came to Richard for treatment again and again because they could not stay away, and Richard's apparent satisfaction that this should be so. It is quite evident from Richard Kennedy's testimony, already quoted, that he had from the first, no doubt unconsciously, regarded Mary Patterson's teaching merely as an addendum to manipulation, and that the more successful he was, the more certain he became that, for him at any rate, manipulation was the only thing that mattered. And so the partnership was dissolved in the spring of 1872. It had lasted less than 2 years. Yet, when the final accounting was made, Mary Patterson's share of the funds accumulated amounted to some $6,000. She remained, for the time being, in the apartment over Miss Magoon's school. Richard took offices further downtown. Richard Kennedy enters into the story of Mary Patterson's life for several years after this, and in many ways profoundly affected the course of her development. Not so much, or at all, for what he was, as for what, in her view, he stood for. He was, to her, by this time, the arch-mesmerist. And in order to appreciate the importance of the part he played in this record, it is necessary to appreciate the extraordinary part which mesmerism played in popular thought in the last quarter of last century. As has already been noted, spiritualism, especially in the years immediately succeeding the Civil War, had overshadowed mesmerism as a popular excursion into the unseen. Mesmerism had had its day, and in that day had held out the promise of many possibilities. There had been, at first, nothing sinister in what the world was led to expect from it. It had been advocated as a healing agent, and many men, like Phineas Quimby, had practiced it successfully in this connection. When it lost favor as a means of healing, it continued to maintain itself as an interesting exhibition, and few forms of entertainment were more common in the middle of the last century than an exhibition of mesmerism or hypnotism by some well-publicized exponent. Up to this time, however, mesmerism, as far as the general public was aware of it, had been practiced only on willing subjects, with the mesmerist personally present. Later on, as was inevitable, the possibility of mesmerizing people at a distance without their knowledge, much less their consent, began to be discussed as though possibly a demonstrable fact. The question was debated everywhere. Short story writers and long story writers began to develop it as a theme. Bram Stoker wrote his Dracula, as did later on Du Maurier his Trilby. But what placed mesmerism as a sinister agent in human affairs most forcibly before the public was Henry Irving's play The Bells, with its tale of horror, centering round the mesmerized murderer of the Polish Jew. The Bells was first produced in London in 1872, and immediately the possibilities of mesmerism as a means for compelling criminals to confess was discussed in all its aspects in newspapers and magazines throughout the world. From this particular use, discussion ranged over every other kind of misuse, until nothing was thought impossible. Upon one point, there was complete agreement, namely, that either ignorance or acquiescence was really necessary to successful hypnosis. This, however, was far from removing the fear of it. Acquiescence could be withheld, but who could guard against an attack of which he was ignorant? The whole subject is still one about which very little is popularly known. The possibility of the most extravagant claims as to the power of mesmerism, in certain circumstances, is still to be proved, but the effect of suggestion, itself a form of mesmerism, on individuals or on large masses of people, is today recognized and traded on to an ever-increasing extent. In 1872, it was still almost a virgin field, and to a man of Richard Kennedy's temperament and parts, it offered unlimited scope for experiment. It has been charged that, after he severed his connection with Mary Patterson, it was this experimental study that claimed and absorbed his interest and practice. To him, it had all the fascination of laboratory research. His one absorbing interest was to see the thing work. He had accepted from Mary Patterson the supremacy of mind. He was now proving it, as he thought, every day. He failed to realize the distinction which Mary Patterson was beginning to draw between the divine mind and what she called its counterfeit, the human mind. But the partnership had been dissolved, and thus, for the moment, all was quiet. Richard Kennedy went his way, and Mary, saddened and troubled, but not dismayed, went back to her rooms over Miss Magoon's school, more determined than ever to go forward. A few weeks previously, in defending herself against the attacks of Wallace Wright in the Lynn transcript, she had declared simply that what remained to her of life would be devoted to the cause she had espoused. "Well knowing, as I do," she added, "that God hath bidden me."